host, Tegan Keating. This week, I talk with Jonathan Pertle. He's a research associate at Drexel Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. He's a doctoral candidate at the Drexel School of Public Health, and he's a founding writer of the Philly.com blog, The Public's Health. I know Jonathan because I'm working with him on my master's project writing for Philly.com. And I didn't realize it when I first started working with him, but his area of interest is in trauma and trauma theory. So we talk about how transformative this one meeting that he attended was for him, because it's where he learned about trauma theory, which he explains better than I could, and how that kind of shaped his career path and how it got him into doctoral studies in public health, particularly looking at trauma. And, you know, and he talks about how if we are able to integrate trauma theory into more of our public health interventions that we have now, that it might make things more effective, because trauma theory brings a different lens to the question of why people have the health behaviors that they have. Maybe, you know, gives a little more insight into why somebody is more hesitant to change than maybe we think they should be, or that we would like them to be. And we also talk about Healing Hurt People, which is a project that is run out of Drexel in conjunction with two local hospitals here that works with young people who are victims of violent crime, helping them to start to heal from it, not just physically, but emotionally as well. Also, before we get into the interview with Jonathan, I wanted to ask you, yes, you, listener, to rate the podcast on iTunes and maybe give me a little bit of feedback. If you've already done it and it hasn't popped up yet, it's because there has to be a certain number of ratings before any ratings will show up. So I appreciate it if I've already asked you and you've done it. But if I haven't asked you and you're listening to the podcast right now, please pause it, go rate it on iTunes. It really helps other people be able to find the show. And, you know, I only know so many people, so my social network can only, you know, do so much. So if we can get more people on iTunes to get to know about the show, more people can listen to it. So I would really appreciate it. I'd be forever in your debt. Thanks. So Jonathan is great to talk to, and it's a fascinating interview, so I hope you enjoy. Here he is, Jonathan Pertle. Pertle, a research associate at Drexel Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice, and also a doctoral candidate in the Health Management and Policy Department, my department, at Drexel School of Public Health. How's it going, Jonathan?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm happy to be in your new empty office.
Yes, nothing here.
Yeah, because we just moved over to the main campus at Drexel from Center City, so there's nothing on the walls at all. So let's talk about you and what your deal is. So we'll just start, like, when did it hit you that public health was like what you were going to do?
So once I was in it, it hit me that it was what I was going to do. So my little linear tale is I graduated from Roger Williams University in Rhode Island with a degree in psychology, and thought I wanted to be a teacher. So I got a job teaching second grade at a charter school in New Jersey, and it was the hardest job ever in the entire world. God bless teachers. Through that experience, I realized that, one, I didn't want to be a teacher. Again, God bless teachers.
Yeah.
But I was also really interested in kind of the structural issues that affected the students I saw, kind of how class and race and ethnicity kind of all intersected and kind of shaped their experiences and how these students interacted with each other. So it was a charter school in a really economically diverse city in New Jersey. So half the kids lived in these mansions on the river next to Bon Jovi. The other half lived on the other side of the tracks, you know, below the poverty line. But they were all together in the same classroom.
Wow.
It was this really interesting experience. All of that led me to realize I was really interested in kind of like sociological questions. So I got a master's degree from the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands in sociology because that sounded like a cool thing to do and a good idea, and it was. It was really, really great education. Grad school is cheap in Europe. Just a little plug.
That's a tidbit of information I could have used a while ago.
So I went to Amsterdam, got a master's degree in sociology. It was in social theory and public affairs. So it was kind of about how abstract social theories from like Bordeaux and Foucault could be applied to, you know, real life problems. And my thesis was on the Homeland Security Advisory System, that goofy color-coded thing that came out after 9/11.
Right.
I was just kind of interested in kind of what was going on because it seemed like a really strange thing. Anyway, the topic of my thesis was public health-y enough to get me an interview at the Drexel School of Public Health to work on a grant devoted to racial and ethnic disparities in disaster outcomes. So you
didn't have a lot of background in racial ethnic disparities at that point. You just knew that they existed from your own experience?
I kind of knew they existed, and I definitely had no formal experience.
Okay.
So I Googled public health before my interview and read up on epidemiology, whatever that was.
Right.
Learned what
Never
it was.
Heard about that before. Yeah. It's not the science.
I really was not aware of public health as a field, which is very telling,
mm-hmm.
Until I learned about this job and then Googled it. And, you know, I knew about some of the issues that are talked about in public health, but I really didn't know about it as a discipline,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is one of the reasons we have this blog, which I'll talk about later.
Right.
So I got this job working at Drexel, completely funded by this research grant, to work on a range of projects related to racial and ethnic disparities and disaster outcomes. So this was after Hurricane Katrina, kind of all the poignant imagery that came out of that. The federal government was kind of like, this is not okay. We have to do something about this. And if you look back in history, there is a long legacy of these disparities going, you know, all the way back as we have documents about disasters and pandemics. Socioeconomic disparities, but then also racial and ethnic disparities as things like culture, language, trust in government all kind of play into it. So that was my in to public health. As I stayed at the School of Public Health, I started to work on different grants related to racial and ethnic disparities. So I got into some work around healthcare reform and the impacts of different proposals on racial and ethnic minority groups in the U.S. I started working on some projects related to access to primary care and quality improvement and cultural competence, and kind of this broad brush of exposure of working on different projects related to racial and ethnic disparities. So that kind of really stoked my interest. I loved it all. I loved it because I saw it as kind of applied sociology. I really loved sociology, but a lot of it did nothing. You just kind of wrote and thought and theorized, and it was fun and interesting, but it kind of stopped there.
Mm-hmm.
And that public health was, everything I worked on was kind of about doing, you know, trying
yeah.
to advocate for very specific mm-hmm. change
yeah.
or make this happen or make that happen, where it would actually improve the lives of people. And I really, that was like very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my MPH in the executive program at Drexel while I was working. Another tip, if you want some free education, work for a university and you can offer free education. And the MPH kind of gave me the broader, you know, idea of what public health was about and EPI and EOH and all those
right.
all those different disciplines. So that was great. Everything was great. And then my position was totally grant funded, as a lot of positions at that level are, and my boss at Drexel left. He went to the University of Texas and then took all that money with him, kind of orphaning me and the other staff. That's how it goes.
Aww.
No hard feelings, but that's how it goes. So that was kind of a blessing in disguise because I was in a weird place, and Dean Gold, who was the dean at the time, was really awesome and just like, let me see what I can do for you. Maybe you can work on this a bit, work on that a bit, and like maybe we can just cover you in this period, and then something else will open up,
mm-hmm.
and you can keep.
That's
working.
Great.
That's great.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. She was very supportive. And in that period, Dr. John Rich, he knew that I was kind of looking for work, more or less looking for projects, he had gotten a grant from U.S. Office of Minority Health to convene this group of experts and write a report on the impact of trauma and adversity on the health of African American men. So this is a topic I didn't know much about. I knew about disparities. I kind of knew they were really complicated. I knew a little bit about trauma from my disaster work, mm-hmm. PTSD, but really not that much. But they needed a writer for this project. They got this grant. They needed somebody to go to Washington, sit in a room with all these experts for 4 hours while they talked about these issues, and then write the report. So I said, all right, that sounds cool. So I went down there, really not knowing that much about any of this, to attend this meeting. It was all audio recorded, but I should be there. I was there, listening, taking notes. And I was blown away by what I learned in that room. It moved me at a very deep level, and I learned so much that I had no idea about.
Do you remember who was there?
So Bruce McEwen was on the phone. He's the guy who's kind of developed the concept of allostatic load, which is really interesting. Howard Pender Hughes, Robert Anda, who was one of the PIs of the original ACEs study, James Gilligan, who's a psychiatry professor at Harvard, just all of these really, really big names in the fields of trauma and FES and developmental psychology.
So if you were going to learn about trauma from anybody, that was like the best group of people.
This is like the best possible circumstance.
Lucky.
Sandy Bloom, who was the first time I met her, who's here at Drexel School of Public Health, but I hadn't met her before. Just brilliance all over the place, and all these people just kind of chattering about these issues and sharing their ideas. And I'm like, this is amazing. This is so cool. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this was around the same time I was starting the Doctor of Public Health program here in the Department of Health Management and Policy at School of Public Health. So while I was working on set projects and getting my MPH, I decided I wanted to get a PhD or a doctoral degree in public health because the field is awesome and where I wanted to be.
Is it a DRPH?
It's a DRPH.
What's the difference?
So on paper, it's a practice-based degree, so like MD, JD, these are practice-based degrees as opposed to academic degrees.
Okay.
So like an MA, MS, PhD, academic degrees, MPH, DRPH, MD, JD, those are practice-based degrees. Who makes that distinction? I don't know. Probably somebody. But I think the distinction is, you still have to write a dissertation, you still have to take a lot of research methods courses. But I think the bottom line is you graduate ready to do public health and not just be a researcher. So you have the research skills, but you also have leadership skills and are ready to do. So work for a health department, work for government, run a program, and kind of do what comes with that. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Just in my own, when I was looking at schools and when I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do next, I've looked into all different types of programs, and in public health it's pretty tough to find a PhD program. There's just not a lot of them, so it's confusing because there isn't really a great description of what the difference between the two is. So it's interesting to have to talk about a DRPH on this as being the same type of degree as an MD or a JD or an MPH, that they're very like professional. You can go into the workforce and work, whereas if you got a PhD in public health, it might be a little bit more difficult to walk into a health center and have all of the skills that you would need to be in a leadership position there. That's good to know.
So this experience writing this report in Washington coincided with the start of my program. I quickly decided I wanted to focus my dissertation and kind of have my niche in public health be within the context of trauma and public health. And I want to work with Sandy Bloom and John Rich and Ted Corbin and these real leaders in the field that are at the School of Public Health. So that's kind of what I've decided to do. I did my coursework while I continued to work. I worked for the Center for Public Health Readiness and Communication here at the school for a year, kind of continuing to work on preparedness stuff, and then had the opportunity to join the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice in 2011, I believe, as a research associate primarily working on an outcome evaluation of Healing Hurt People, which is a violence intervention program that operates out of Hahnemann University Hospital and St. Christopher's Hospital for Children.
And that is, my understanding, it looks at trauma among adolescents and young people who come in with like gunshot stabbing wounds, like who come in with like physical trauma,
right?
Who also, there's, you know, a lot of emotional and other types of trauma,
right,
as well.
So the idea, one of the ideas behind the program, is that there is no psychosocial standard of care for violent injury in the United States. So what that means is you're shot, you're stabbed, you're beaten up, all of which to the point where you have to go to the hospital. Your physical wounds will be taken care of, no doubt. If you have short insurance at the time, it doesn't matter. It's an emergency. Your physical wounds will be cool.
That's EMTALA, right?
What's that?
EMTALA?
EMTALA. But there's no recognition of the fact that, you know, being violently injured, having someone hurt you, is a potentially traumatizing experience. It can lead to very tangible things that we know about, like PTSD and depression and trauma-related disorders. And even if that injury doesn't lead to, you know, those full-blown conditions, it still has an effect on a lot of people. And a lot of people also, you know, they're discharged from the hospital without any real way to stay safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So someone intentionally injured you, and you're treated and discharged to that same community where that person often is who tried to intentionally injure you.
Right.
Which is dangerous for the patient, and it also increases the risk of retaliation. It's very logical if somebody's trying to kill you, like, well, maybe I should do something, because they're going to do that.
Right.
So we intervene, so we do a couple things. So we address the trauma of violent injury, and so many of the clients in the program and patients, you know, in Philadelphia who've been violently injured also have these histories of trauma throughout the life course, as a lot of people do in society, period. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
is not a Philadelphia urban specific thing. This
right.
is a human thing. But we address kind of those emotional and psychological and social needs.
Mm-hmm.
We also provide case management services to help people, you know, stay safe. So, you know, maybe they have to stay with a relative after they leave the hospital. Maybe they can move to a safer neighborhood, hook them up with education, job training stuff, so they can, if needed, change their trajectory towards one that's safer, which
mm-hmm.
everybody, all these patients really want to do. But a lot of kind of the sense is, in a lot of hospitals, is that a lot of people got themselves shot. They got themselves hurt. They were doing something they weren't supposed to be doing.
Blaming the victim?
Exactly. And not seeing them as a victim or a patient. So we kind of...
Seeing them as what, then?
Seeing them
a
as...
A gunshot wound?
And kind of... The line between victim and perpetrator is very, very fuzzy about how these patients are viewed generally
mm-hmm.
in hospital systems, which is very unjust in our eyes. And something we try to change. In addition to the program, Healing Hurt People really change the conversation about violence. And this is what John Rich and Sandy Bloom and Ted Corbin have been doing for years, really trying to change this conversation to one of trauma. And you
mm-hmm.
know that violence is trauma. I mean, and in addition to, you know, being more socially just in how we address these issues, that will be more effective is really kind of the bottom line, that when you do an intervention taking all of this into consideration, you'll get better outcomes because
mm-hmm.
you have a better understanding of the people you're working with.
I know that, so I'm taking Dr. Bloom's class, so this is a good
yeah.
exercise for me to talk to you about this. We just read this week a book chapter or an article that she wrote about trauma being like germs,
mm-hmm.
like the germ theory, and how that revolutionized the way that we practice medicine. And if we can convince enough people that trauma is communicable and that it's just as devastating to people, if not more than
yeah.
infectious disease, that maybe we would be able to fix a lot of our bigger problems that we have.
Absolutely. Everything we do in public health is based on some theory, and often these theories are implicit about the way behavior changes, why people do what they do, how they do it. And what trauma theory brings is a whole different lens about why people are doing things that they're doing. And looking through that lens, right, we think that things can be much more effective. So, you know, the paradigm has often been, let's give people more information, tell them why
mm-hmm.
things are bad for them, what they should do that's good for them. And that's important. That's part of it,
mm-hmm.
probably. but also really kind of understanding how complex, you know, behaviors are in a lot of ways, and how trauma kind of feeds into that, can we hope and we think can kind of make all public health interventions, or a lot of public health interventions, more effective and, you know, achieve better outcomes.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because we spent a lot of time in school talking about all these different theories of behavior change and, you know, why people take a lot of time to make changes or why they try and fail. And right. I know that, I mean, we can all look at ourselves and see the things that we know that we do that are unhealthy.
Right.
And you try every January 1st, you're like, this is going to be the year.
Right.
This is the year that I'm going to eat 8 servings of vegetables every day. Yeah. And it's like a week and it's over. And that, no matter how much you know, it doesn't, you can't always make, like, change those habits because you have habits for a reason.
Right.
And the thing that I'm finding really interesting about trauma theory is that it explains why those habits happened and how, and what you need to do to be able to get to the place where you can change them. So it's not just about, you know, eating your vegetables and you know that you need the fiber and the phytonutrients and all that stuff. But it's more about, well, why do you replace those foods with unhealthy foods, because that was a coping mechanism that maybe you you developed at a certain point that was traumatic in your life. It's really it has changed my outlook on a lot of things, and I've only been in the class for 3 weeks, so I can only imagine what a lifetime of it would be like.
It's incredibly transformative, and that's how I felt when I learned about this stuff, that this light bulb's going off.
It's like it all makes so, like, that's what it makes so much sense.
Yeah, it does. Once you get it, it makes so much sense.
Especially, I think, in the context of being in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
which is such, has such problems with violence.
Mm-hmm.
And when you live here or you live in an urban area that has such huge health and wealth disparities from block to block, you can kind of start to see how not just individual trauma, because like you were saying, like, people have trauma regardless of their socioeconomic status, but how community trauma really can impact people's individual health and their trajectory in life.
And also, I mean, I think there's a lot to be learned about resilience in these communities too, that have these, you know, are exposed to violence and have these kind of chronic trauma exposures. I mean, there's a lot, there's unbelievable resilience in these communities, and I think often we've really focused on, you know, the negative and on deficits and the impacts of trauma. But also, you know, there's a ton of resilience as well, and understanding that and how we what we can learn from that.
So when you say resilience, what do you mean?
Just people, some of the stories I hear about things that people have experienced in communities in Philadelphia blow me away, that they are so, that they're here and they are articulate and they're inspiring and, you know, They've survived it, and they have this very positive outlook on the world, and it's unbelievable. And I put myself in their shoes, and I feel like I would have been crushed by those experiences over my life. And somehow people are able to, you know, really find strength and power and overcome that. And it's amazing. So just better understanding, what are those dynamics? What can we learn from that, you know?
And
in
how
addition to preventing exposure to trauma, but how can we mitigate its effects?
And how can we teach people how to, because a lot of that presumably comes from the family. So how can you teach parents to kind of integrate those protective factors, knowing that life is difficult, no matter who you are and where you live, knowing that your child is going to experience some kind of hardship and trauma in their life. And so what can you do as a parent to kind of help them get on the right track?
So I think that's, in terms of trauma theory and public health, I think we're really early. I mean, there's a lot's known about trauma and how trauma affects, you know, psychology and biology and behavior. We know a lot about that within the field of traumatic stress studies. We haven't really thought about how to apply that at the population level yet. And we have these, you know, a lot of studies showing the relationship between different trauma exposures and adverse health outcomes and health risk behaviors. But we haven't really figured out the best way to take all this knowledge about trauma and transform it into effective public health interventions. So right now I think we're at the kind of the consciousness raising stage where we're trying to get this information out there. So the same way I heard about it for the first time, we've blown away and you're blown away from from Sandy's class, I think we're really kind of getting it on people's radar. And while having the opportunity to work at the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice and see Sandy and John and Ted talk about this stuff to audiences who really haven't heard it before, talking to, you know, public officials and to police officers and people who really didn't have any exposure to this knowledge before they came in, how it transforms them. Pretty much everybody, it really resonates with pretty much everybody. So I think we're at the stage of trying to get it out there and trying to just get this in people's frameworks of why things are the way they are and what we can do about it.
Do you think it's on that trauma theory is on the radar of like the CDC and like on a more national level?
So it's interesting with the CDC. So the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study was, I believe the original one was funded in part by the CDC. Rob Anda, who was the co-PI, was an epidemiologist. I'm pretty sure he's still with the CDC. And if you Google Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, you'll find a CDC website dedicated to the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, just to go back, was a large retrospective cohort study that found a really strong association between the number of what were called adverse childhood experiences people experienced before age 18, to things like child abuse, child neglect, having a person with a substance abuse problem in their household while they were growing up, having a family member incarcerated. So the number of these things that happened and risk for chronic disease and health risk behaviors. So one of the co-PIs, Rob Anda, is at the CDC. So the CDC kind of gets it in that respect. You can learn about trauma and health on the CDC website. Other materials I've seen the CDC put out about the integration of behavioral health, i.e. mental health and chronic disease prevention, I haven't really seen much acknowledgement of the idea of trauma and that the causes of some mental health issues and physical health issues are the same, and that cause being, you know, lived experience, trauma. So all that to say is I think that some domains of the CDC get it, but others not. I think the CDC kind of, they're innovative in a lot of ways, but not always, you know, and I think that's how government often is, and that's okay. But it's kind of, I think, you know, up to practitioners and people in academia to kind of push this knowledge forward and get it into the federal agenda. But at the federal level, I mean, I think there is, and over the past 2 years, there's been a lot more work around trauma and acknowledgement of trauma outside the context of just mental health. So in SAMHSA, there has been, you know, there's a National Center for Trauma-Informed Care. The field of psychology and psychiatry, pretty much, they've gotten trauma for a while.
Right.
But the Department of Justice, for example, has been funding work around trauma. They see how that really, really is very relevant to their work.
Yeah.
And you know, the Office of Minority Health, as I mentioned, funded this report that I got to write. So I think it's definitely getting out there at federal levels.
Because that would be helpful. The more people who know what's going on,
right,
the better it is to try to, you know, get the right research out there and develop these interventions that we need. So it's really interesting. Do you think that there is something unique about Philadelphia that has drawn, because you mentioned three different people, and I mean, we have the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. That's what, yeah. We have that here at Drexel. Do you think that there's something unique about Philadelphia? Do you think that like our city is going to be more inclined to kind of embrace this? And
so I think Philadelphia as a city has been inclined to embrace it, and I think it's a really exciting place to be in the context of trauma and trauma-informed care. And from what I understand, we're definitely kind of a leader in the area. So Healing Hurt People, the program I mentioned, this trauma-informed program, is funded by the Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health. So they get it, and they see this as important. Dr. Arthur Evans, who's the commissioner of the Department of Behavioral Health, or director at the head of it, he really gets trauma and trauma-informed practice. The president-elect of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies is at Penn, Nancy Kasem Adams. a psychiatrist named Steve Berkowitz, who's a real leader in the field of traumatic stress studies in the context of children, is also at Penn. And for whatever reason, a lot of leaders in the field really are here in Philadelphia. So it's a really exciting place to be. I think the city definitely does get it. I think change comes slow in government, but Philly gets it, and it's very cool to see how they get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of figuring out what to do with it, and I think that there are no absolute right answers yet. I think we're still trying to figure out the best way to take this information to improve health and people's
And it's
lives.
Great because, you know, everybody will get to try out their... their ideas on Philadelphia, which can be good, like that will be good for the city, as long as I'm sure that they'll all be well thought out, wonderful plans. But, you know, to be able to say, like, this is the city that we're here, like, we're in it and we're going to help fix it.
Right.
And yeah, it's great because Philadelphia needs lots of love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the blog.
Okay.
So tell me about how that. Tell me what it's called. I know what it's called, but you know what I mean.
So the blog is called The Public's Health. It's a blog and column with the Philadelphia Inquirer that Professor Mike Udell here at the school and I started, I guess, a little over 2 years ago now. Now it's, quote unquote, ran by Michael, myself, and Janet Golden, who's a professor of history at Rutgers in Camden, who started writing for us a couple years ago. And pretty much... Michael and I met with the Inquirer, I guess, in summer of 2012, and kind of pitched this idea that, you know, the public is not really engaged in conversations about public health, ironically. There are stories about public health issues, there's health reporting, obviously, there's great health reporting, but it was all slightly different from a public health perspective, and what a public health perspective brings and kind of that 10,000-foot view of looking at the social determinants of all these health issues and really kind of having the conversation in a broader context. So we met with Carl Stark and Don Zapatkin, who are editors at the Inquirer, kind of pitched this idea, and they liked it. They thought it was a cool idea, and they have been amazingly supportive in helping get this thing up and running and supporting us throughout. So what we do is we write probably 2 to 3 times a week. Michael, myself, Janet Golden, you, other experts from the field who write for us. And we write about the whole gamut of public health issues from, you know, implicit racial bias to hydraulic fracking to drunk driving to smoking, just everything. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. So our goals are kind of, I think, our mission, you know, is really to kind of engage the public in conversations about public health, increase the understanding of what public health is as a discipline. I think we're a discipline that's not very good at branding ourselves. I think it's really difficult to brand ourselves because what isn't public health? Our boundaries are pretty loose. Yeah, pretty wide and keep getting wider as we see, you know, the root causes of so many health problems. You know, they're in the housing sector. You know, they're in education. So it's tough. So we try to help people understand what public health is. Translate some public health research into kind of public speak. So some of the posts we write will take an article that we feel is really interesting and important and kind of translate it for the public in 500 words and put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, it's the only public health blog in a national newspaper,
so
is that right?
To our knowledge, it's the only public health blog solely dedicated to public health that's affiliated with a major U.S. newspaper. So there are obviously health columns and, you know, health sections of newspapers all the time, but if you look at them, they are different than what we do and what we write and how we approach these problems. It really is from a public health perspective, which just looks different. And I didn't know how it looked different until we started doing it. But you can compare and contrast kind of how a story written by a health reporter about a study looks different than the story written about from a public health reporter and kind of the lens through which we view just causality and solutions and research and all of that stuff.
So you think, like, what kinds of feedback have you gotten from readers? Have you gotten anything?
So mostly, you know, the thing with the comment boards is it's like
trolls.
It's like 12 bad ones for every one good one.
Yeah.
So like lots of what could be perceived as like mean, nasty, horrible stuff, but it's also where people are at, which is real. Like that's really how they feel, and that's really what they believe, and that's really important to know.
Yeah.
From a public health perspective, I mean, in public health, you have to be able to communicate with people who do not share your perspective on things at all. And it's good to see how people do view these issues, and through getting those comments and those nasty comments, and sometimes nasty emails, and even nasty phone calls.
Phone calls.
We've learned. I've never gotten phone calls. I think Michael got a phone call.
Wow.
But
you guys also talk about autism a lot, which is pretty.
Michael does. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that causes a stir.
I'm sure.
There's an organized contingent of anti-vaccinists.
Yes.
Who are very very vocal. But in getting all these comments, I mean, I think it's changed the way we write, to write in a way that trying to help that person see your side, even if it's just a little bit, even if they still write the crazy, mean, racist, mm-hmm. not so comment, they'll still write the comment, but maybe they just get it a little bit. You know, maybe they see where we're coming from.
So do you feel like you write to that person, that, you know, the imaginary person out there?
It'd be too hard to write if I wrote to that person. I'd get really sick of them. But I think of them. But they're one of the people that reads every draft. I have them in mind.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have. There's a weird amalgam of a person I write for. So this is one of my professors told me, you always have to write for somebody. Good writing is always written for somebody. Otherwise, it will just be poor writing.
Right.
And I do, I can't describe who that person is, but it's a mix of that mean commenter and art editor and public health professors who I admire,
mm-hmm.
and my mom, and all, it's all of that kind of mixed in. It's fun. It's a fun thing to do. It's, it takes a lot of time, but it's really, it's enjoyable. It's a nice break from academic writing, where
mm-hmm.
you have to write in a very different tone, and it's an excuse to research things that I would never research for any other reason, and really kind of, and be an advocate, like, a, you know, use science-based advocacy and really advocate for things I believe in, which is very cool and empowering, you know, it feels good.
It's kind of like channeling. I know I find myself, I get interested in a subject, and then you like end up like in the rabbit hole of whatever the topic is. It's a good way to channel that into something productive, and
absolutely.
Not just a wasted 2 hours where you're learning everything about what I think I went on last year. I went on like an anti-fluoride like rabbit hole where I just read everything for hours, and then I was like, this was, I mean, I'm glad I know this, but it wasn't helpful.
Yeah.
But this is a good way to channel that.
Totally.
Yeah. So
to do something.
Exactly. So, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
They can email me. It's my name. It's jonathan.pirtle@drexel.edu.
All right. And then also read your stuff on the public health.
Philly.com/public health.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
That's Jonathan. His work is really interesting, and I highly suggest that you check out what Healing Hurt People does. And also, shameless plug for my own projects, check out the philly.com blog. It's philly.com/public health, and it'll be right there. It'll pop up fascinating stuff. There's like so much public health history that is written about, and current events, and explanations of studies that come out, and really interesting perspectives on lots of different topics. So I highly suggest that you check that out this week, because you might find something that I wrote there. Never know. So as always, thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week. Thanks so much for listening to Action Phase. You can find me, Tegan, on Twitter @TeganKeating, that's TeganKeating, and on my site, TeganK.com. You can find Action Phase on Twitter @ActionPhasePod and on ActionPhasePodcast.com. You can feel free to email me at ActionPhasePodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.